Hello, and welcome to Tide Talk, where we bring the events in the East to the rest in the West. Today with Dr. Fabio Lanza of Arizona University. He is the author of Behind the Gate, Inventing Students of Beijing. He has a master's in tourism management and economy of tourism from Beijing University, and a PhD as well as another master's from Columbia University's East Asian Languages and Cultures program. Dr. Lanza is the current professor of modern Chinese history at the Asian History Departments, and teaches such courses as Chinese Civilization and Communist China, History and Narrative. Without any more delay, how's your semester been, Dr. Lanza?
It's been long, as it usually is, but good.
Yeah, it's been a very long semester. I'm very much in agreement with you. Never seems to end.
And, for 16 weeks, it's long.
Let's get ready for some questions. And just in case you weren't familiar with the format, we have five questions prepared for you. And if there's time left over, there will be a sixth one tailored to your civic field. You'll have a couple minutes each to answer each question, and hopefully we'll get to number six. Are you ready?
Sure.
Question number one. Are there any circumstances that would lead to the U.S. getting to a conflict with the United States?
The China, you mean? The China getting a conflict with the United States? I can imagine one, not at this moment. There is the specter of Taiwan, but even that one, I can imagine a direct confrontation between the U.S. and China. That would be, maybe I lack imagination, but that would be absolutely devastating. So my answer would be, I can think of one.
I love the optimism. I love the optimism very much needed these days.
As I say, optimism or lack of imagination. I sincerely don't think that, well, as long as rational people are involved, I don't think that any, neither of the governments want a direct confrontation, for sure.
Do you think there's any factors that would lead into a sort of irrational governance? As you alluded to.
There always is the possibility of you know, a moment of irrationality, but you have to have a moment of irrationality at various levels here. It's neither China, despite our impression of China being one man person thing, but neither China nor the U.S. are exactly a one man person government. The president has enormous power, so does the president of China. But it will take a serious amount of really massive mistakes and fuck-ups to get to a direct confrontation. I can imagine many scenarios in which somebody will come in the middle and stop it. But again, I might be excessively optimistic.
No, we need optimism nowadays. Are you ready for question two?
Sure.
In the event of an armed conflict between the United States and North Korea or Russia, do you think China will come to either of its allies' aids?
No. Also because neither of them are properly allies. I think there's a misconception here that China is ally of Russia. China keeps a very ambivalent position, if you want, a very nuanced position toward both the US and Russia. It's not against Russia. It keeps supporting them with certain amount of products and, you know, not directly arms, but things that can be used for war. But it's not a, there's no NATO pact between China and Russia or North Korea. There is a NATO pact on the other side, but there's no NATO pact between these people. They're not technically allies. And I don't think that the Chinese will go out of their way to risk World War III. The relationship between China and Korea is complicated, but it's not a relationship with the Chinese love the North Koreans. Quite the opposite. They find them annoying as hell. So there are strategic reasons why they support North Korea, because they don't want to basically U.S. bases or a U.S. ally on the border, but they have a good relationship with South Korea. They have a good relationship with South Korea for a long time. I don't think that you can construct them as allies properly. Also, again, too optimistic, but I don't think that the U.S. want a war with Russia, for sure, a direct war for Russia. That's why there is a proxy war right now. And also, they don't want a war with North Korea, who probably has nuclear weapon and somebody crazy enough to use them.
Admittedly, all cards on the table, I'm in full agreement with you, 100%. There's too much geopolitically at risk for any sort of armed conflict.
Oh, yeah, it'll be a fucking disaster. Sorry.
I will ask, though, the U.S. has been making a very concerted push to ally itself even stronger, create more military relations with, you know, the Philippines, North Korea, Japan. Would, in an event that there's a stronger, like, NATO-esque in the East treaty sign, do you think you could push China to make its own coalition?
Yeah, I think that's a risk. I don't know to what extent, but I always think that there is. That's what happened with you know, I mean, you can argue many things, and you can argue that, you know, that you didn't have to get to this point. But, you know, the what happened with Russia is that you constitute a NATO alliance, which usefulness was debatable at the time, and push it to the very border of Russia, which fuel the worst possible element in within Russia. And then you have a probably rational leader in the case of Putin, and you start a war. I think China got spooked over the years by the 2008 financial crisis, first and foremost, but also by the so-called pivot to Asia that Obama started, that seemed to reconstruct again China, not simply as a competitor, but as an enemy. And they got, I suspect, spooked by that. And therefore, there's been like a dual sort of hardening of the rhetoric on both sides. So, yeah, the problem is that the new Cold War idea doesn't benefit rational solution of problems, quite the opposite.
So, in essence, it's rhetoric outpacing logical conclusion making.
I think so. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, if you think about it in terms of like the global world system, and imagine the consequences of an economic war between the U.S. and China. It would be devastating for the world economy. It would just be a disaster. You know, think of what the pandemic did, or what the sheep in the street of, or, you know, on whatever it was, that, you know, or blocking the street of Hormuz will do. Imagine that multiply, like, I don't know, 100 times, and then you have the effect of you know, a confrontation between, not even a war, between the U.S. and China. It will be devastating for everybody. And I think people know that. I still don't understand why there is this desperate need, especially on the U.S. side, of fueling the rhetoric. I don't get it. I don't understand it.
I wish I understood too, personally. So, pursuing that a little bit more, you talked about an economic war, and I know you're not an economist. What are your thoughts on decoupling? That's the Trump era and now Biden era of decoupling.
I understand why they're talking about it, and it's something to talk on both sides. This at least is something talking more emphatically on the U.S. side and on the Chinese side, but the Chinese side has made provision to, or has tried to make provision to shelter their economy from an eventual economic war or decoupling and things like that. Like, you can argue that the Belt and Road is a, among other things, the constitution of an interland of sort, that you have like resources that are guaranteed to a certain extent, and that will allow the Chinese economy to function in provision of a breakdown relationship with the West or parts of the West, maybe. I think decoupling is almost impossible in practical terms. Again, I'm not an economist, but I read economists. Isabella Weber, who's written about this, wrote a long time ago that decoupling was insane and it couldn't work. The decoupling means restructuring it's not two countries. It's not like taking, like, you say, okay, we have factory years, we remove factories from China and put them in Detroit, but put them back in Detroit. Like, hey, let's put car factory back in Detroit. It's not that simple. It's an entire supply chain system based on just-in-time production, in which you place an order and your parts of your car, and I'm using a car as an example, parts of your, you know, the thing you're ordering comes from different supply chain integrated in a particular way to get this thing done as quickly as possible with as little consumption of resources as possible or time lost as possible so that it gets delivered to you. So you have to restructure not just a relationship between, like, you know, two closed system, but an entire global economy. I can't imagine it being done, for sure not being done quickly. And it will take, like, it took decades to build the system. It will take decades to build a different system.
Sadly, for time's sake, we will have to move on to the next question. And our next question is, if China becomes the world economic leader, which it's currently at pace to be, how will life change for an American citizen?
That's a good question. Historians are really bad at making predictions. It might not change at all. I mean, does it change if China is the largest economic power in the world, largest economy in the world, given the fact that it might have the largest GDP in the world at a certain point, but their GDP per capita is comparatively low, and it will stay comparatively low for a while because there are so many people compared to the US, which is much higher per capita GDP. So will it change? Maybe not. I think what will change massively the situation of American citizens is if there is a collapse of the US-China relationship, if there is a disruption of the global supply chain. Not that I particularly love the system as it is, but, you know, all of a sudden, if you don't find stuff at Walmart anymore, or if your gas prices go up 40%, or the price of your eggs or something else, or tomatoes, which we import from China, but, you know, things like that, or your car goes up, you know, that's a serious thing. If China becomes the largest economy in the world, maybe nothing will change. I can't imagine. Yeah, they will have relatively more power, but relatively, it's still, you know, again, a collapse of the global economy system, and every shock to the global economy system at this stage hurts everybody, including China. That's why 2008, 2009 was such a scary moment for them, because it hurt them.
It's also a question of what Chinese, I'm going to say domination, which is probably a bit of a pointed word, but Chinese hegemony would look like in terms of how it comes to fruition and how it's maintained. My constant thought is I don't think the Chinese government, at least as it stands, is in a particularly militarist mood about their plans. So I don't think it would be some sort of economic collapse that would make China dominant. It would be more of a gradual scheme over time that came to fruition. And, like, if that doesn't come with a bunch of instability, then perhaps an American wouldn't even notice.
I'm not a military expert, and I will not claim to be in any way, shape, or form, but I have friends who work in military institutions, and they all argue that China, for example, is not ready to invade Taiwan on the military standpoint. They don't have the physical... this is not me. I sincerely don't know this stuff. But what they say is that they don't have the military capability. So if you don't have the military capability to take over Taiwan, I don't think you have the military capability to pose a military threat to the largest military in the world by a lot. China spends a fair amount in military, but compared to the US, spends almost nothing. I think they don't have militaristic expansive push right now. This is also controversial. The Chinese have one base, and I think they're opening another one in the rest of the world. I lost count of how many the US has. We are comparing apples and oranges here, at least in this specifically. The Belt Road Initiative is not a military expansion operation, unless you count these two bases. One is in Middle East, and I don't remember what the other one is. So it's relatively, it's mostly an economic expansion, which is real, probably, and it's the thing, but it's a different thing. They might be militaristic internally, so towards or in at the border, let's put it this way, and they make show of force of their, especially navy, in relationship to, you know, South Korea, the Philippines, Taiwan, and things like that, and it's a regional dominance, especially in the South China Sea, but it's not the same as you know, expanding their military power all over the world.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, though, and this is question number four, Chinese economic faltering seems to have, at least in your mind, would have way more of an impact rather than Chinese success. So the question is, if China falters economically, what does it look like, for instance, like for somebody in, say, Ohio or Arizona?
It looks bad. It looks bad. And, you know, China's economy has its problems. So, and again, I'm not here to make any forecasts, but China's economy has a problem. What the Chinese economy, up until like a few weeks ago, it was reported it was growing at, you know, a relatively low rate, like 2-3%. Recent reports say it's now growing at 6, but or even more than 6, I don't remember. But you know, it's much more substantial growth. So when the original reports were like, and there were doubts about the Chinese economy is, you know, China buys stuff, China produces stuff. You know, China is a market for a bunch of things now, luxury product, but also food, you know, and things like that. China imports enormous amount of stuff, including agricultural product, from rice to soy sauce, to soy, not soy sauce, soy, to pork, and other things at the level. So if you have a massive collapse, for example, the famous real estate bubble in China or something like that that makes the Chinese economy collapse, their reverberation are even temporary, are enormous, because you have the second largest economy in the world just stopping. You know, when the financial crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis hit the U.S., China got hit, not so much, because of financial crisis, of the collapse of all the financial markets, but also because the U.S. stopped importing stuff from China because nobody had money. And there was a financial crisis. And so all the workers in the factory in South China were out of a job, basically. And because they produce stuff for the export market, and the export market in the U.S. and Europe had altered, basically. So if you imagine the reverse, that's the other side. And everything... So it would be devastating. It would be, you know, again, the second largest economy in the world. If there is a snag in the second largest economy in the world, there is a snag in the global economy.
And our final question before I move on to something I'm actually really excited to ask about. Question number five. North Korea occasionally pops up in the news. They've been known to do their chauvinistic moves. Is there any real chance of a nuclear exchange between the U.S. and North Korea?
Oh, God, I hope not. Again, historians not good at forecast. So, you know, in the case of China, I usually tend to say, you know, that you can argue that the communists, the leaders of the Communist Party might be evil, but they're not stupid. Or crazy. In the case of North Korea, it's much more difficult to say that because it's a very strange state with, you know, almost a dynastic system, well, not almost, a dynastic system of basically dictatorial power, very opaque in how decisions are made, and so on and so forth. And it's been a problem that's not been solved for decades at this point. Pacification has not bridge to pacification was much closer, at least normalization relationship was much closer 30 years ago than it's now. I mean, I remember when they were building the train that will go from North and South Korea, which of course never worked, but was a possibility. So I hope not, and I think in large part it depends. I think North Korea got a nuclear weapon largely as an insurance. You know, seeing what happened to other country that didn't have a nuclear weapon, and they're like, okay, if we get a couple of bombs, that's a life insurance, basically.
Yeah.
And so I hope that it works. I mean, I hope that the mutual assured destruction, or at least the assured destruction of like Seoul, will prevent stupid stuff to happen.
Changing gears to a little bit more of a lighter topic, and we're probably going to run over time, and I apologize in advance, Garfield. I want to ask you about your book, The Behind the Gate. Tell me about it.
My first book, yes. Okay.
Can you explain to it as short as possible?
Yeah, that was my first book. My first book was about it's something before the contemporary situation, so it's about 1919. It's about the student movement that led to the emergence of student politics in China and eventually also the formation, if you want, of the Communist Party and of mass politics in China. The main movement of May 4th, 1919, which is a movement protesting the transfer of German colonies in China to Japan instead of back to China. So it was a nationalist movement. But I studied in a particularly one university, and I studied how that those people got involved in politics, how they expressed their politics, and how the creation of the very idea of the modern student as a political actor took place in those years. So it's a case study for China specifically, but it's a case study more largely for how people become political. And how especially young people come to express politics and embody politics in particular act, be there street demonstration, clothing, specific behavior, specific rules of behavior, specific ethoses and tradition of behavior that are associated often with one school, one movement, one particular category. Yeah, so that's the story of that specific book. It's a long, it's the beginning of a long fascination with political participation and political activism.
How does it impact, or does it impact, the modern Chinese student body, given the changes since 1919?
It did until 1989.
I was going to ask, yeah.
in the sense that in 1989, student made reference to May 4th and March, specifically on May 4th, 1989. There was a famous text published by the students in Tiananmen Square called the New May 4th Movement. So that tradition lasted until, for sure, 1989. I thought it was gone. But it reappeared briefly during the student protest, the very much minor student protest of 2019, when Marxist students at various universities organized, I would say, small protests, small campaign in support of workers and things like that, and got arrested and captured and suppressed. But there were reference to May 4th, the tradition once again. Almost 100 years later, literally 100 years later. So I thought it was gone. I thought it was that the tradition had completely, and that reference had completely died, but it didn't. It's just buried down in the belly of Chinese politics right now.
You said you chose one college as a case study, correct? Why did you choose that college?
It was the only university in China. It was easy. It was the only public university in China. It was Beijing University, still around. Also, it was central to the movement, and it has a particular tradition to this day, to a certain extent, of political activism. So looking back at 1918 also allowed me to trace that tradition of political activism. And
did that coincide with your study at Beijing University?
89? I was in college in 89 in Italy, and I was supposed to go to China that summer for the first time. I didn't. I went to China the following year, in 1990. And I think that led me to, yes, in many ways, studying students. 89 was an important thing. There were also student movement in Italy at the same time. So I was surrounded by student movement at a certain time, and I decided that probably to study those for a reason.
I hate to cut you off, but unfortunately we're out of time. But before we go, could I ask if you had anything to say to the viewers, any words of wisdom?
No, not particularly. No, keep informed. Keep yourself informed on China, and not everything you read in the newspaper is right.
Wise words. Thank you for your time, yeah. Doctor.